I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Even in the midst of war, students in Ukraine are taking action on climate change.
If you want to see the future of any country, we can just take a look at their youth. And I'm so proud of my youth.
Vladislav Kocher is a teacher in the city of Vinnytsia. Each year, his students participate in Climate Action Project, a program run by the nonprofit Take Action Global. It's a free 6-week program open to classes around the world. Students learn about the causes and effects of climate change, and they work on solutions in their communities. This year, Kocher students planted trees and created a campaign to remind people to conserve energy and water. And through the program, they shared their knowledge with other students around the world.
This year, my students had virtual interactions with the students from Dubai, Israel, from Sierra Leone, from India, for example, and other countries.
He says especially now, when the country is at war, his students play an important role representing Ukraine.
They become the voice of Ukraine at international level. And they always tell me that the most valuable thing for them is to understand that they are part of this global community and their voice is heard.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me today is Hale. First thing that I want to talk about this episode is Wittgenstein's epistemology. I encountered Wittgenstein's epistemology in an epistemology class. Something that really interested me about Wittgenstein was that Wittgenstein seemed to have an answer for a radical problem, a fundamental problem in epistemology. And in epistemology, that radical problem is radical skepticism, the possibility that we might not actually be justified in knowing anything at all. The account of Wittgenstein was, or Wittgenstein's account was actually laid out by an expositor, Michael Williams, in an excellent book, The Problems of Knowledge. What was really interesting about this account was that, so Michael Williams has a framing of the skeptical problem in epistemology. Now, you're probably more familiar with the typical Cartesian problems of epistemological skepticism. So things like, how do I know that there is an external world because I might be deceived by an evil demon or a brain in a vat? Those are very popular images in philosophy about, well, how do we really know that we know anything?
Yeah, those are kind of, at least to my knowledge, the sort of quintessential radical skeptical arguments. That you can propose a situation in which everything that you seem to know could be undercut, and there's no way for you to tell whether or not that undercutting is or is not the case. So like another one, like an obvious one that people say is like, how do you know you're not dreaming right now?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, like you could be potentially in a dream that seems entirely like normal reality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you would have there's no clue effectively. And then that obviously rotates out into if what is true for you is effectively what you're experiencing in some kind of way, and you have some sort of relation to, whether it's through your senses or mentally, and all of that is potentially false, then, or not real, or not what you think it is, then there is no room for you to know anything.
Yeah, how do you get outside it to confirm it, essentially? But what is really kind of gripping about Michael Williams' account is that he takes a far more radical form of skepticism, and it's what he calls the Agrippan trilemma. It is based on Sextus Empiricus's five modes, essentially five propositions that, if you accept them, lead you to a skeptical position. Now, for the academic skeptics in the ancient Hellenic world, this was supposed to bring you to a state of what we called epoche, where you would give up trying to, you would see that it is pointless to try and come to any sort of conclusion, and you would reach a certain kind of nirvana state, as it were. You would suspend judgment. But for contemporary skeptic, or for contemporary epistemologists, it's actually quite a problem, because we want to, our common sense picture of knowledge is that we're justified in knowing things, and we're not just interested in suspending knowing things. We're not actually skeptics. So the Agrippan picture of skepticism is that there's two, so it's five steps, but there's two sort of stage setting steps. So the first is that people disagree about basically anything and everything. This is a common experience that we have as knowing beings. We disagree about a lot of stuff, but also we can qualify or justify what anyone is saying, because we can say it's true for you. So we disagree about all kinds of things, but we can also say, sure, according to you, or it's true for you that any given thing is true or false, or you know or you don't know something. Now, what this is supposed to do is to lead us to say, well, that's not really true. We actually think that certain things are justified, right? We have beliefs, and those beliefs are justified. It's not all just up in the air. It's, things are not just true according to you or anything like that. But that's where the skeptical problem really sets in. Once we are committed to saying that beliefs require justification, those are where the three modes, the Agrippan trilemma, come in, which is the mode of infinity, the mode of assumption, and the mode of circularity. So we run into a problem as soon as we say that knowledge requires justification. You either encounter an infinite regress, just infinitely justifying knowledge. So you have an infinite regress. You make a dogmatic belief, you just refuse to answer, you state a dogmatic assumption, or you make you repeat yourself at some point, so you make a circular argument. Those are ways out of the Agrippan trilemma, but those are obviously insufficient if you really accept the first two modes, that knowledge requires belief, right? So yeah, you really get yourself into a pinch if you accept the stage setting, and you accept the, if you accept the picture of knowledge as the skeptic lays it out, right? Now, what Wittgenstein is really, or what I encountered in my epistemology class that was fascinating, was it seems as though the contemporary attempts to justify knowledge are just theorists really intelligently biting the bullet, right? So it turns out that foundationalism is just argued for, it's foundationalists argue that actually, yes, we can make assumptions. There are dogmatic beliefs that we can say, you know, sense perception, or Descartes with clear and distinct perceptions and whatnot.
Yeah. Like foundations of knowledge effectively.
Yeah, essentially. And
yeah, you're basically setting yourself up to commit to certain propositions as being fundamental.
Yeah. Even
obviously foundational.
Yeah. Even though it is incompatible with the accepting that, yes, knowledge requires justification, we just say, well, some don't, right? The other one is the mode of circularity. These are the coherentists. Now, the coherentists think that it's the relationship between all the beliefs that we have and the coherence of our landscape of beliefs that justify our knowing things. So it's like a really sophisticated circular argument, basically. So you can see that both of these are people biting the bullet. Okay, Agrippa, yes, we have to give in to one of these modes. Now, the interesting one is the mode of infinity. Justification in terms of an infinite regress, right? Because it's an infinite regress. You have to keep doing it. Whereas with the coherentist and the foundationalist picture, you really do come to a stop, right? For the infinitists, that's not necessarily true. If you come to a stop, you could continue, right? That seems to be the picture that Wittgenstein lays out when he is talking about in his epistemological work on certainty. In his epistemological work on certainty, that seems to be the picture that he lays out in what is famously known as hinge propositions, right? Now, hinge propositions, according to Wittgenstein, are that, so I will just, I'm going to read the quote of Wittgenstein from the article. It's the article is Michael Williams, The Indispensability of Knowledge. So let us take a closer look at the hinge passages. So this is Wittgenstein justifying stopping the infinite regress, that we can actually stop at some point and have justified beliefs. The questions that we raise and our doubts depend on the fact that some propositions are exempt from doubt, are, as it were, like hinges on which those turn. That is to say, it belongs to the logic of our scientific investigations that certain propositions are indeed not doubted. But it isn't that the situation is like this. We just can't investigate everything, and for that reason, we are forced to rest content with assumption. If I want the door to turn, the hinges must stay put. So this is hinge epistemology, that I can doubt any given proposition, right? But if I want to doubt something, if my doubt is to make any sense, then my doubt presupposes certain beliefs that make that doubt sensible, right? So, for example, if I doubt like a certain historical event or something like that, I have to assume that history is a thing. I have to have beliefs that stay put about history. I have to make assumptions about the agents in that historical event, about certain causal laws, about the way that history, as opposed to like what we, you know, material causality or something like that. So hinge epistemology is this idea that if you are going to doubt, you have to, things have to stay put. And the reason that this is a viable response to the skeptic is because the skeptic is doubting things, right? The skeptic has laid out this five modes, and these things stay put as the skeptic is doubting any given piece of knowledge, saying, okay, well, are you justified in this or are you justified in that? There's all kinds of stage setting that the skeptic is relying on, that any given doubt or belief about anything else is also relying on, right? So any given, what we call, might call like a mundane doubt or a mundane belief or anything like that, is on an equal footing with the skeptic's, skeptic's radical doubt. It starts to look less radical according to the hinge picture of things. It just looks like someone doubting things.
So just for myself and the listener's understanding, The structure of hinge propositions is initially very like enticing.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, I would not consider myself a skeptic, so perhaps I'm like antagonistic towards like that, the more extreme versions of that view, for other reasons we can discuss later. But the hinge proposition system, to me, I guess when I make a mental model or picture of it, it seems to sound kind of coherentist, where it's basically like, it sounds more like if you're, say I've got plot A that I'm going to doubt, well, plot A, the only reason like you can even doubt that or consider it or whatever, consider it as like an object of doubt, is that it effectively sits within a web of other beliefs and systems that make it even possible for it to sort of arise in your view,
right,
in your view. So to me, that's as you were saying that a little bit of this kind of thing, it sounds almost a little bit more like kind of coherentist, kind of like a web knowledge type system. But I actually, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't really think that it is.
Hmm. It's interesting. I think you're right to have coherentist, sort of, to see coherentist resonance with it, because in a certain way, there is a structure. So the world is structured a certain way, and we have certain beliefs about that world. So our beliefs seem to have a structure fitting that world, right? The hinge propositions depend on that world sort of staying in place such that you can doubt things or have beliefs. Whereas the coherentist picture is a bit more relational, not in relation to the world, but to the way that, or the, yeah, the coherentist picture is more confined to the relationship between the beliefs themselves. Wittgenstein is, and the hinge epistemologists are very willing to say that things, it's not so much their relationship that justifies each other. It's just the fact that if you want to doubt, you have to stand on some ground in order to doubt, right? You have to make certain commitments.
Yeah, and that component of it is, I think, very intuitive.
Yeah.
That doubting does not exist in a vacuum.
Yeah. Now, what's really interesting, so this is what I was really fascinated by in Wittgenstein, that, wow, there really is this answer to the skeptic. However, this paper, The Indispensability of Knowledge, it pokes a real hole in this picture of hinge epistemology as giving an answer to radical skepticism. It seems like a really compelling picture until you realize what exactly you are buying when you buy hinges. So there's two things going wrong with hinge epistemology. The first is that apparently, according to Michael Williams, hinge epistemology actually doesn't secure the kind of answer to skepticism that we would think. We might be able to grab the skeptic by the shoulders and show them that, yes, you too have to stay put when you are doubting things, but the skeptic isn't really committed to any particular beliefs. They are more or less just poking us in the chest, saying you're not actually rationally justified in what you are believing. What Michael Williams is saying is that far from answering the skeptic's challenge, hinge epistemology and hinge propositions are what Duncan Pritchard calls irrational commitments. And these are precisely what the skeptic is claiming that we are not justified in having. We are simply making an assumption. We can doubt everything, but if we are going to doubt, then we have to make irrational commitments in order to doubt. But that doesn't sound like justification. In fact, it's a totally irrational process. And so the skeptic still kind of has us in their crosshairs. We're not actually justified. We haven't answered their challenge yet.
In theory, like if you're like, okay, these aren't justifications, you have irrational commitments. If we're going back to like the sort of web model that I initially pictured with hinge propositions, kind of akin to coherence, where it's like, okay, I'm going to doubt that this, for our listeners, I have a notebook in front of me. I'm going to doubt that this notebook is real. Okay, well, to doubt that, I have to doubt the concept of a notebook. I have to doubt the space of my room. There's, you know, the possibility that I'm engaged in some sort of activity here, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, the initial move is to say, okay, well, radical skepticism is impossible because that there's a sort of requirement for a bunch of other things to be in place for you to even doubt them. And since those things are in place, it's not a fully breathed skepticism.
Yeah.
But I think if you make the move that it's an irrational commitment, like the more advanced skeptic would want to, effectively what you could do is you could kind of move your optic from commitment to commitment.
Yeah.
And basically say, okay, well, now we're going to doubt you being in this room right now. And then we're going to doubt, okay, well, is there really a concept of notebook? We can move it over and do that. And you could basically just like sort of move the crosshairs wherever you want to.
Yeah, you can move the, I don't know why, but I'm thinking of like a jewel loop or something. You can move it around wherever you want onto the, onto the table. But that doesn't mean that you're justified just because there are parts of the table that aren't doubted yet. You can move it anywhere. The skeptic's question can really be put to any proposition. And any time that you say, okay, well, that depends on things in order to doubt, the skeptic is saying, well, you're not actually justifying those claims. You're just depending on them to do this doubting. But that's not to answer the skeptic's challenge of saying, are you justified in having these beliefs? Again, you have accepted these first two modes, and you have committed yourself to thinking, well, we're justified in our knowledge. But these do not sound like justifications. These just sound like conditions. And the conditions, if you're admitting they are irrational, that you just depend on them, again, that's not justification. Now, what is interesting about the hinge propositions is that Michael Williams wants to say that just as much as these fail to answer the skeptic's challenge, they also fail as a reading of Wittgenstein. So one of the, there's another passage that Michael Williams cites, which precedes the first passage that I quoted earlier, and it gives more context for what Wittgenstein is actually talking about when he talks about hinge propositions. Recall what I quoted earlier. Here is him leading up to this. We know with the same certainty with which we believe any mathematical proposition, how the letters A and B are pronounced, what the color of human blood is called, that other human beings have blood and call it blood, et cetera, et cetera. So Wittgenstein is not claiming when he talks about hinge propositions or uses the metaphor of the hinge that what we are making are irrational commitments, because he explicitly says that we believe these things, right? So he can't be talking about an answer to skepticism, because if they are things that we believe, these presuppose a solution to skepticism. So the hinge propositions can't be Wittgenstein's answer to skepticism. Now, this should be kind of astonishing, because it, from what I can tell from reading the literature and gauging the slow uptake of hinge epistemology is gaining ground. But if Michael Williams is right, it's based on a misreading of Wittgenstein. I remember I was browsing through Routledge. They had the book publisher, they had a sale recently. They're always having sales, but there was a commentary on Wittgenstein's epistemology, and the front cover was, it had a door hinge on it. This is me reading the literal cover of a book. I'm judging it by its cover. Maybe it's a commentary, maybe it's a criticism, but the point is that a theme in Wittgensteinian epistemology is hinge propositions, but Michael Williams says that he wants to kill hinge epistemology quickly before it spreads, because it is spreading. So if hinge epistemology or the image of the hinge can't be Wittgenstein's answer to the skeptic, the question becomes, okay, well, what is? Because Michael Williams does think that this is that on certainty, Wittgenstein's work is the most radical answer to radical skepticism so far. And it's something that I think that the hinge epistemologists are trying to do, but in focusing on the metaphor of the hinge, they commit themselves to irrational commitments and whatnot. But it is this idea that certain, so with Wittgenstein, we have this idea that certain things can make sense and certain things can't make sense, right? And sense has conditions. Sense comes from the meaningful use of words, right? So it can, you can fail to make sense when you are using words, right? And one of the things that you can fail to make sense of is doubting. Now, with hinge epistemology, you depend on certain propositions to make your doubts and whatnot. That is true. But there are just cases where doubt doesn't make sense, right? And this is what Wittgenstein actually opens the book with, where he talks about G.E. Moore's proof of the external world. Here is one hand. Here's one hand and here is another. If you do know that here is one hand will grant you all the rest. I'm quoting now. When one says that such and such a proposition can't be proved, of course, that does not mean that it can't be derived from other propositions. Any proposition can be derived from other ones, but they may be no more certain than it is itself. So we have these propositions like, here is one hand, here is another. If someone were to, so let's say a skeptic was to say, well, how do you know that? We might answer in certain terms as, well, I can see Murray's raising his left hand on his left side and he's raising his right hand on his right side. I can see that. And if the skeptic continues to push and say, well, how do you know? Wittgenstein wants to point out that at some point, the question of how do you know or are you justified just doesn't make sense.
So eventually you hit a wall in your questioning.
Yeah, you hit a wall in your questioning, but you don't just hit a wall in terms of like, okay, well, I don't have the conceptual apparatus to answer this question. We might say that if I can't see Moore's hand, well, here's one reason I wouldn't be able to see Moore's hand. There's no light. The lights aren't on. So if you turn on the lights, well, whoa, there it is. Like, okay, I can see it now. Or, you know, he's doing this in at a philosophy conference and I'm at the back and I can't, you know, I have to squint to see it. I can't see it very well. Is it his left or his right hand? I can't tell whether it's really being raised. If I say, okay, I can't see it or I doubt it, I should be able to make sense of that doubt, right? Whereas for the skeptic who has an unqualified, highly generalized form of doubt, that doubt, even though certain stage setting has been done, it doesn't make sense to doubt certain things under certain conditions, right? That's what Michael Williams means by saying that a certain objective certainty is contextual, or that it makes sense in a deeply circumstance-dependent context, as it were. It's not that the context is built up by hinge propositions, but the context is built up by the sense of that doubt, right? Does it make sense to doubt in this instance? Sometimes it does. You know, there might be someone standing in, or if I'm seated in the conference hall, there might be someone tall sitting in front of me. I can't look around them to see whether Moore really has his hand up. In that case, it would make sense to doubt. If we think about it, it might not. It doesn't make sense to doubt it. I just can't see it. But this is a radically different way of approaching the answer to the skeptic than just by saying, okay, well, the skeptic depends on propositions in order to doubt, and that means just because we do that as well, we're all in an embodied sort of everyday world that has things that stay put. This is different than that. This is saying there are conditions for doubt. Sometimes it makes sense to doubt. Sometimes it does not make sense to doubt. And in the philosophical study where we set out all of these conditions for getting to knowledge as such, it doesn't make sense to doubt everyday objective things that we believe, or propositions, or even perceptions.
So then what exactly, I think the question